Oh, yes, it is good to have our hearts prepared with solid truth. And that last one was kind of a prayer. But I do have a question for you. You read any good books lately? Sometimes we get asked that question and we're trying to figure out what is it that we want to read. How do you determine whether you're going to read a book? Like, do you judge a book by its cover? You're not supposed to. So I've got some here, and let's judge this book by its cover. You want to read this one? I know what we should do. Let's just open up the first page and see what it says. We will investigate God's eternal decree or purpose and its relation to human decision-making and responsibility. Oh, integrative theology. Now, maybe you shouldn't. Is that the way we do it? We could do it this way. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. Now, do you want to read that one? Some of you would say, oh, that brings back trembling things of high school literature class. Tale of Two Cities, 1859, Charles Dickens, is there another book to choose from? I read that one once and kind of remember it, but is that what we're talking about here? I've got other ones. If you aren't going to judge it by its cover, sometimes you can because people invest a lot of energy. How about this one? Personal Finances for Dummies. Brightly colored, and it just screams, read me. Or maybe one like this. How Becoming a Contagious Church. Increasing Your Church's Evangelistic Temperature. And then they put on this little graphic on the cover, a flame, looks like a burner from a gas range, but the point that they're trying to communicate, even with the artwork on here, is you ought to read this. This has got something that would help a church realize that they can go reach people and maybe have some fervor in that. You know, you can find books that are on the bookstore shelves, and you might be drawn to them. They market them that way. Somebody else might have a book that they recommend to you. Now, this particular book that I brought from my house off the shelf that my wife is using for decorating, along with some other ones, has a 1921 copyright date. And it's kind of cool. I do like old books and looking at them, and I'm intrigued with them. And I open this book up. Now, this is the Common Word Speller for the 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. A spelling book. And this particular one has this cool little artwork in here of a car, probably from the 1920s, 30s era, pushing a cart along with a little story in there. And I'm intrigued to pick this up and digest it. And I see on here, on the bind, right in the words here, it says, F-A plus A-B. Mr. F-A has a crush on Miss A-B. I'm sure that's what that means. And when I open this up, I find the word Forrest Austin. This was my dad's. And he's in heaven now, and I can't even find out who A-B is. All I know is it's not my mom. But I'm compelled to look through here and see what other clues I'll find about that. And when I was looking at that, I've got a motivation to pick that up and kind of look through it. Why? Because there's a compelling interest that I have in it. But if somebody else recommends a book to me, I'm probably going to be more motivated to pick that up and read that. If someone gives it and says, you really need to read this one, it probably moves up a little bit. Now, let's think about this for a second. We don't judge a book by its cover. We don't open up the pages and see what the first few lines are to see, does that capture our attention? But then what do we do? What if I said, I'd like to have us spend some time with a book that demonstrates how God uses socially and culturally powerless individuals who possess strong faith in him to overturn or transform a culture, a society. If I get a book like that, are you interested? What if I went on and said, but there's more? What if this book shows how obedience to God brings blessing both to the individual and then to society as a whole? Are you in? You want to learn something about that? What if I said, okay, do you expect God to do anything different at Calvary? Or Wisconsin Rapids? Or in our country in the years ahead than he's already done? What if I said, you know, this book shows that God's Spirit in a person equips them to do exactly what he wants them to do to accomplish a purpose that they didn't see coming. Now have I got your attention? Are you interested in that kind of thing? And you're going to say, I know what you're going to say. We're in church. You're going to talk about the Bible. Well, yes, I am. But those statements are true nonetheless, and I don't want to talk about the entirety of Scripture. I want us to look at a book called the Book of Samuel. Now, you say, wait a minute, I learned the books of the Bible, and there is a 1 Samuel and there is a 2 Samuel. What's the Book of Samuel about? Well, when it was first put together in the Scriptures, the Hebrew Bible had it as one volume. 1 and 2 Samuel were not designated as different parts. It was just called the Book of Samuel. I aren't even sure Samuel wrote it. I don't know who wrote it. And then when it came time for the Greeks to really translate the Hebrew Bible into that language, the Septuagint, that's a Greek translation of the Old Testament, that's when they split it into a two-part volume, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. And that book addresses the big picture truths about God that I've already talked about. Now, what are some of those things? Well, first off, there is this promise that comes out in the book of Samuel that we would commonly call this Davidic covenant, a promise given that there is a descendant of David's that will rule on the throne forever and ever, and it is trustworthy. That is yet to be fulfilled, but the promise is very real. What are some other big themes in this book? Well, that God's sovereign hand is over the affairs of people, individually represented by the person on the bench, but also collectively, nations are there. And so you see that in this historical account, there is this overarching theme that God is sovereign that way. God's Spirit enables people to do things. It empowers them to do things for his purpose that's there. You'll find that there. It's really difficult to capture the Spirit visually, but you get the idea that that's another theme that comes through here. And then finally, there is a picture of God's view on sin. I mean, he deals with people individually and then collectively. That little summary isn't all that's in this book. But if you had to paint these pictures, why did God give us this point of history? It was so we would understand more about how he is unfolding his plan in the affairs of people. I love the book because it's got some great stories in there, but the stories are not meant to be told in a children's Sunday school class so they are entertained on a given Sunday. The stories are given for you and for me. As I were coming to this message today. And you might say, well, boy, by the time we're done listening to this, this could have been preached on Mother's Day, and it might be a good spot for it, but it's in the very first part of this book. And The Godly Mother and the Seeds of Change is looking at the events in the first chapter of Samuel. However, the setting of the story really goes back to the period of the judges. And we know the story of Samson, and we've got Gideon, and there's Jephthah, and there's, you've got this unfolding. In fact, some of you have been around here for a few years. You'll remember when Pastor John led us through a study on the book of Judges. The end of that book has this statement, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Kind of a depressing label. This book is coming in right on the heels of that, and it tells a story of Samuel and of King Saul and of King David. We're introduced to them and all of this. But the setting is such that things weren't going real well. And people did what was right in their eyes, not necessarily what was right in God's eyes. And so much so that you see this decline in the effectiveness of the priesthood. That's going to become apparent. This place that they met for worship at Shiloh, kind of an unofficial capital location for Joshua when he was trying to take possession of the land and give the instructions there, it kind of stuck there. And then we find that the Ark of the Covenant that was part of their worship, is suddenly moved, captured, taken away. Man, it's a tough spot there. Then we get this godly mother. I'd like you to look with me. First off, and we'll take a look at Hannah's sorrow. We're going to be introduced to some people here. It's 1 Samuel 1. And there was a certain man, Ramathim, Zophim, of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives, and the name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peniah. And Peniah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. And on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peniah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah said, her husband said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? Oh, there's the context. Hannah has a heartache. It is one of those events that you just can't miss when you're reading the story here. What is it that troubled her? Oh, she was childless. They didn't have any kids. She was in a marriage with a second wife. And I know some people would say, oh, well, must be that God's okay with having more than one wife. It's in the scriptures. But every time we see that show up, there are a couple of things to remember. First off, it is not ever taught. It's not condoned as a wise practice. There were cultural things going on there, and Elkanah just, he had two wives. Well, wait a minute, didn't Sarah do the same thing with Abraham and bring Hagar? Yes. What about Jacob? I'm talking about wives. You sure God's not okay with that? I'm just saying that every place you watch that happening, There's difficulties. Well, that adds to the complications there. This lady, Peninnah, was kind of obnoxious. She had the kids, but Hannah had none. You can read from the text that more than just one or two. She had sons and daughters, and she had nothing. Now, in that culture, why would Hannah have valued children? Because it was the livelihood of the people group. It was part of how you got wealth in those days. You had more resources, human resources, to support and to carry out. There was value in that, not just for those economic reasons, but because God said families are a good thing. And she felt like, if the Lord's closed up my ability to have kids, I'm just, what's my purpose? I don't know. I think she had a high view of children. And I think I can support that from the verses that follow. But what she did have was a right relationship with her husband. Now, I'd say this from a couple vantage points. First off, she was one of those people that tracked with her husband. It said in the text that I just read that when they went to worship every year, she was with her husband in this. Didn't stay back. Didn't try to make excuses for this, like, Why should I go? It's just going to be painful. The whole family gets to be involved not only in the sacrifice but in the feast that comes out of that. And I'm just reminded again that I have no children. Now, they shared worship together. Now, couples here, hang on to that point. They shared worship together. Elkanah wasn't a perfect husband, was he? No, guarantee he wasn't. But he was trying something. He was working at this, and this was his routine. He set the course that way for him. And I think that she drew some kind of strength and stability from that, in the same way that I believe Sarah got strength from Abraham because of his leadership in that way. Why is this sharing worship together such a critical piece? I believe it knits hearts together in a way that nothing else can. Why else would we find over and over again this principle in Scripture that a believer should marry another believer? A person of faith needs to marry another person of faith. That's not just something that shows up in 1 Corinthians. Let's go back. Joshua 23, when they were settling the land, he gave this instruction. In fact, it was really at Moses' hands before that. But Joshua reminds him, he gives them this warning, don't make marriages with the people you're supposed to drive out. They will be a snare and a trap, a whip to your sides and thorns in your eyes until you perish. Well, that's just an encouraging prospect. He was very blunt and said, listen, it's going to weaken you and it will have the same consequences that these other things graphically declared would. Ezra, the prophet, said this, don't give your daughters to their sons, neither take their daughters for your sons, so that you, now he's meaning as this chosen group of people, would remain strong. So you find this thing all the way through. Why does God want people of faith, believers, united together? Because it's impossible to bring up children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord as easily. I shouldn't say it's impossible. There are unique challenges to accomplishing that if the husband and wife aren't in agreement on it. I mean, even in 1 Corinthians, a woman is free to be married whomever she wishes, only in the Lord. You can look wherever you want, and you're going to find that principle there. And the point I'm making is, it says it continued this way year after year in verse 7, that Hannah went with the family every year. Now, I know Exodus 23 says there are three different times of the year. I'm not sure what happened in those other times or if those were included, but the author just noted this one feasting time that they came together. I also want to point out one other thing about their shared worship together. Do you think The worship environment at this time was solid. The author gives us a little foreshadowing, if you will. The sons of Eli were there, Hophni and Phinehas. They were not good guys. That'll come across in a later message. But he's alerting us to that. It's not a healthy environment, and yet they went together that way. I love that. Not only did they share worship together, I think they shared love together. I read the portion in there about Elkanah giving his wife a double portion. Why would he do that? Is it just to make her feel better about not having kids? I don't think so. He loved her. He genuinely loved her. A double portion was something you'd give to an honored guest. And gentlemen, you can tell your wife you love her. Or you can say, we got married, didn't we? And you wait and say, wait a minute, I told you then. But the actions that speak of your love are critical. So those of you who are married, the men, pay attention to what he did here. This outpouring, a concrete, tangible expression of love meant something to her. And they shared that love because of the actions that were there. He worked hard to reassure her, to build her up, to affirm her place in his heart, even though there were circumstances that he couldn't fix. That's why I think that although he wasn't beyond mistakes, that he had a heart that was pointed in the right way. And this lady, then, is good in her response. She had sorrow, but she weathered that because I believe her husband was nurturing the soil she was growing in. I really believe that. So those of us that are in that boat, pay attention to that little illustration. What is it then that Hannah did? She had a supplication or a prayer that was quite intense, I might add. She really wanted a child, and she was deeply distressed in this, even after her conversation with her husband, because he was saying, well, look, I have given you a double portion. Aren't I better than 10 sons? Come on, aren't you satisfied with the fact that I love you in all of this? Verse 9. After they had eaten and drunken, Shiloh arose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple. And please, when you read temple, don't think the one that Solomon built. This was a tabernacle-like location here. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. You get the idea. There's passion in this. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant, remember me, and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. And those of us, is it, really? No, I want my son to have a haircut. What was this Nazarite? Well, it had nothing to do with being from Nazareth. But you have this individual here, soon to be named as Samuel. We have Samson and we have John the Baptist that had this Nazarite vow where they were set apart. That Nazarite means set apart. That's all that means. But as she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth, and Hannah was speaking in her heart. Only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. Might I just stop and say the guy was a lousy judge of character. Now, think about that for a moment, and maybe it will spin back in to say, what kind of worship environment were these people in? That the priest sees this lady and assume that she's drunk. I wonder if Eli had watched other people that were drunk in that environment. We know that the two sons had, I mean, we're going to read about that later, had some issues there, and their character was suspect. This declining environment was obvious to everybody, so much so that when this lady is pouring out her heart to God, that the priest said, "Lay off the sauce, lady." He was so far removed from what was going on. I can't help but think there was something else in that environment that we don't often get that way. Now, in her supplication, she demonstrates that she had a right relationship with God. It wasn't just in her sorrow that she had a good relationship with her husband, but here we see that she had a right relationship with God. She knew that with this burden she had, she was able to talk directly to God about this, and that's what her intention was, crying out, making this vow, "If you hear me, Lord, if you grant to me a purpose of raising a child, I will give him back." There was an honest assessment here. This wasn't, "Please, give me one kid so I can get Paniah off my back. Give me one child so that I just have something to give to my husband." No, her motivation wasn't that. The reason I know that is the track record that she displays afterwards. So what happened? She had a surrender. Surrender to the reality of what her circumstances were like. But here's what I loved about this. In this environment, Eli gives her a reply. Then Eli answered, verse 70, "Go in peace, the God of Israel, grant your petition that you have made to him." And she said, "Let your servant find favor in your eyes." And the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. Do you see that, ladies? Her circumstances did not miraculously change. All she had to go on was the truth that was given to her from Eli, the one that thought she was drunk. She still had no children, circumstances still in the same environment. What changed? Her countenance changed. It says she was no longer sad. The circumstances in life did not move at all. So that's why I said, I think she fits this godly character. She allowed the truth of God's word to so run her life that when her circumstances didn't change, she just accepted God's truth that way. "Go in peace. The God of Israel, grant your petition as you've made." I love that. And then she surrenders this thing. What does she do? The very next thing. They arose, verse 19, in the morning, early in the morning, and worshiped before the Lord, and then they went back to their house. All right. Done deal. And the two of them, husband and wife, had relations, and she finds herself expecting a child. I can't imagine what that did, what kind of excitement that brought to her. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name, "Heard of God, Samuel." For she has said, "I have asked for him from the Lord." What happened? She surrendered to the plan of God, and she demonstrated a right priority with her family. Now, we get this from these closing verses of this section. What happened? Well, the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow, but Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever." Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you. Wait until you've weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took up with her along a 3-year-old bull and ephah of flour and a skin of wine. She brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. She stepped back and explained why not right now. The travel, all that stuff, I've got to care for this child. I know that this is an important piece, but I know my responsibilities are right here, right now. Please don't misunderstand. It has nothing to do with my intent. Do I need to go back and remind all of us what happened with those Old Testament vows? The wife couldn't make a vow if the husband wasn't in agreement with it. So this was a joint venture. They knew what they were signing on for with this thing, and we find this priority that she had to her family. So she stayed back, didn't go to Shiloh until the child was older. And then when she does go, she brings the sacrifice of thanksgiving. Now, some of you are reading ESV. Some of you might have New King James. You might have another translation, and you're going to see a footnote in there that says, oh, wait a minute, there's a question here. Are we talking about a three-year-old bull, or are we talking about three bulls? We aren't quite sure. Well, the text is a little uncertain here. We got some manuscripts that say one, some say the other. And I'm going to tell you, I don't care. And does that mean it's not important? Well, I don't know that it's important. You can get lost in the argument over which text. Are we talking about three different bulls that are being sacrificed or one that was 3 years old? And you miss the point that her response was one of praise and thanksgiving. So remember that when she was coming through her learning in this and her response was one of gratitude that she offered this to him. And if you want a little glimpse ahead, some of you know the story. She continued to love her child by preparing clothing for him and taking it to him as he grew. And can you imagine letting the child serve in that area with Eli, an old guy, with a couple of sons that are bad examples in so many ways, and we're talking about a young child. Where was her confidence? It was in God. She had a priority that way. As we end our message with some application points here, I want to ask you this. The truth of this story isn't in what happened to this couple. The truth of the story is God's at work in the individual lives. You and I both know people that have prayed for children and God said no. Some of you know people that God gave a child and then that child was lost, died through circumstances, health, just disease, whatever. And you know people have cried out to God. So what is it that we're taking away from here? That sometimes God says, yeah, you can have kids, and other times no? Well, I suppose. But I think there's a bigger thing here. God is unfolding his plan, and he's using individuals in the process of that. If we look back at these relationships that are in the home, husbands, are we putting the right kind of soil together for our wives to flourish, to display the kind of character that pleases God? For the ladies, and I think it's broader than ladies, and I don't think it's just married ladies I'm talking about here, but because there's a point at which we all can identify with, I can't change the circumstances. I wish I could fix this problem, this situation, but I can't. And you hear the truth of God, and you just say, okay, I can handle this. Not because of me, but because of who God is. There's another layer. When I think back about implications for here in this church environment, have you ever been disappointed by things that happened within church or ministries? All I can say is, can we learn from this example of a family that chose to follow God's plan for worship, even when the environment was less than stellar? That's putting it mildly. You've got a priest that judges wrongly for a character. You've got these sons of the priest that are running their own show. It's not about pleasing God, it's about pleasing themselves, and they're abusing the people that are there to worship God. You talk about a corrupt worship environment, and yet they're there obeying God. So then it becomes, well, wait a minute, I've been hurt by people here. There's expectations that I have that aren't met. Can we climb over that? This passage seems to say, if you can't, let's look at the heart. It's not to excuse the corrupt worship environment. It's not to say that God was inattentive to what was going on there. That's not true. But we watch people climb over those hurdles because of their commitment to follow God that way. Can you see the sovereignty of God in the specifics of your life? I trust you can. What I'm excited about in this kind of study, Old Testament, you see God's working his plan out, but he does it through individuals. So then this thing becomes very personal. It's no longer, will this church make an impact in our community? It becomes, Lord, do you want something of me? We had one lady and a husband that said, we're going to follow even though the system's busted. We're going to order our life that way, and we find God using that child is either the last judge, first prophet, however you want to go into that realm. But he's the one that anoints the kings that are coming. God is shifting the whole plan for Israel, and he's done so through individuals. His sovereign plan is at work. Whew. So, do you expect God to do more in our church or in our community or in America than he's done to this point? I hope so. But it comes back to you and me. Lord, what do you want me to do? What kind of role can I have in impacting Wisconsin? Well, I'm not even preaching in a church. I'm part of a church family. See? These people were not leading at Shiloh. They were worshiping. God's sovereign plan uses individuals. Don't miss the big umbrella of what's in this story, because you'll watch him move at the cultural, societal level, but he works all the way through on the individual side of things. Can you adjust that way? Submit to him. Embrace the things that you can't change, but work on the things that you might be able to cultivate a different kind of soil, different kind of action that way. I trust you'll take those thoughts with you. And then, as we look ahead in the weeks to come, we're going to find that there are some others that chose a different path, and there are consequences for that too. Take those thoughts with you. Let's pray. Oh, Father, the clarity of your word means that you are at work in individual lives. And our submission, our understanding of the truth of the word as it intersects with our lives can't be mistaken. Lord, I thank you for the gospel opportunities that were in front of this church family in this past week. I'm sure some of them were recognized and acted upon. It wouldn't surprise me if some slipped right on by because we were inattentive. I pray that as we struggle through the things in life that we wish were different, that we would embrace your sovereign hand in our affairs, that we would be able to continue on with your grace as you promised, knowing that we live in a world that is marred by sin and it's difficult and challenging. I pray that you would build this church, not just in physical numbers, but in strength and focus for reaching the community that you've given to us here. Help us to that end. In Jesus' name.